Blog Talk Radio.
Southern California, this is the Hermetic Hour, and it's Thursday, April 26, 2012. I'm your host, Polk Runyon, and tonight we are going to review my 1980 master's thesis in cultural anthropology at California State University at Northridge, which was titled A History of Magical Cults and the Rise of Neo-Paganism in Southern California. Now, this work has not been published yet and contains what some might consider sensitive material. It briefly reviews the history of the Western esoteric tradition starting in Alexandria, back in the 1st and 2nd centuries, up through the 19th and 20th century magical groups, concentrating on the modern rise of magic and Wicca in England, and as it immigrated to America. Magic came first in the 1920s, followed by witchcraft in the 1960s. The rise of nature-oriented neo-paganism in Southern California will also be emphasized, and it occurred through the turbulent psychedelic era, and we'll discuss the new coven model organizations. Now, I saw this phenomenon as a cultural revitalization movement, and I referred to it as neo-romanticism. It is a sad fact that most contemporary witches and magicians know very little about the actual history of their traditions, especially in relation to other earlier traditions and groups that they may not be aware they are related to. And now we'll open a time capsule and we'll go back 35, 40 years to the thrilling days of yesteryear. And I said, tune in and we'll rip the veil of mystery from our history. Okay, now, this master's thesis of mine it ended up being book length. It's about 60,000 words. And it was the first master's thesis at California State Northridge to be electronically typed and keyed in and electronically reproduced. And so we had this done professionally. And so it was on mag cards in those days. It's nice and typeset, right, justified and book type and whatever. So it was the first one of that, the first one to be that way, and the rest of them earlier were all typewritten. I'm going to read you the abstract, and as you know from listening to the show, an abstract is a little synopsis of what the program or the thesis is all about. So this is the abstract for the thesis. A History of Magical Cults and the Rise of Neo-Paganism in Southern California by Carol Runyon, Master of Arts in Anthropology. And this study traces the development of a Hermetic Pagan Western Esoteric Tradition, inculcating visionary aspects of shamanism from its origin in 2nd century Alexandria through a succession of revivals, Renaissance, Neoplatonism, Rosicrucianism, Freemasonry, and the 19th century British Order of the Golden Dawn, culminating in the present neo-pagan movement. And the first part of this work is derived from research and deals with the European antecedents of the contemporary American neo-paganism. The works of British authors Margaret Murray and Robert Graves are examined. The writings and cultic systems of Aleister Crowley and Gerald Gardner are also considered. The second part of the study is mainly derived from participant observation of the activities of several local cults and interviews with cult leaders and members, a history of local magical cult activities beginning in the 1930s with Crowley's Ordo Templi Orientis is presented. The suburban residential coven model is delineated, and social interaction between cults is described. The neo-pagan yearly round of seasonal festivals is considered. An insider's view of the Ordo Templi Astartes, OTA, and Farfaria is presented, with 9 other cults also covered. This contemporary neo-pagan cult network is viewed as a cultural revitalization movement as defined by Anthony F. C. Wallace, 1966. Shamanic characteristics of the movement are noted following the social anthropological model of I.M. Lewis, 1971. Neo-pagan links to a larger neo-romantic community comprising science fiction fandom and the Society for Creative Anachronism are discussed. And the current neo-paganism is seen as a religious expression within a broader resurgence of romanticism. We have a call. Is that you, Jeffrey? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, who is it?
It's Jeffrey James.
Hi, Jeffrey James. Good, you're right on time. I just finished the reading the abstract of my thesis. That's going to be the main thing we're going to talk about. Let me introduce my colleague and my esteemed colleague, Jeffrey James, who was a Rhodes Scholar and the author of the Magical Evocation of John Dee and Angel Magic and a couple of other notable books. And Jeffrey has just written a novel, just published a novel, on John Dee. And this is and Edward Kelly and their adventures. Jeff, you want to tell us a little bit about that novel? Because we want to get that across.
Well, actually, the novel hasn't been published yet. I actually just sent you a copy because I wanted you to take a look at it before it got published. Because it's the ideas in the novel are very much influenced by your thinking on the subject of evocation and that branch of magic. But I'm very intrigued by the subject matter of your session because, as you know. I think like we first met, I think, in 77 or 78. So I was there at the tail end of some of this stuff that the neo-pagan movement in California and Los Angeles, and in fact know many of the people and met many of the people who I assume you'll be talking about. So I'm hoping
right.
that at least for some I'll be able to maybe give a little counterpoint and a little bit of another perspective because
yeah.
I haven't been there with you at the time.
Right, because, in fact, I don't know if I'm broaching confidence here, but you and I and our friend Dave Kennedy, who was one of Rigardi's protégés, we started that little Golden Dawn temple called Isis Osiris at the time, if you recall, you had just finished doing the Enochian book, and I recall we did get you we had a connection to the British Museum at that time, and we got you all the microfilm on these manuscripts for that.
Yeah, we had the microfilm, and I went through and laboriously printed them all out. It's amazing now, all that stuff is now available. You can get it scanned it's all scanned on the internet now, so
oh,
all
yeah,
those original
yeah.
manuscripts. But actually, at one point, I went to the British Library itself and examine the manuscript, the key manuscript myself, which was quite an interesting experience to be handling the pages that John Dee himself handled.
Yeah, and you also dropped in the Bodleian too, I think, didn't you? When you were over there, because some of Ashmole's stuff is over there, I think. Anyway, this was all a wonderful time. Back in those days, that shows our age, doesn't it? But back in those days, magic was really in the air, and we were really full of ourselves and doing it and having a grand toy still are. But I mean, there was more of an air of excitement about it in those days. Now it's kind of I won't say it's regularized itself because magic never will, but it's always the unknown. But it's become more by this time. It's more of an acceptable kind of thing. We were breaking new ground at the time. So let me get into reviewing this thesis a little bit, and we get to the point where we know we start knowing people, and so just hang on with me, and we'll get into it. Now, one of the things, what I did, and I don't know, Jeff, whether you ever read this thesis of mine, it never got published, and I didn't try
it. I recall us discussing it in the late 70s.
But you know, I didn't try to publish it because it has some sensitive information in it. I use pseudonyms in a couple of places, but then in other places I used actual names of cult leaders and one thing or another. By the way, let me say this about this use of the term cult. I'm using the term cult in an anthropological sense. This has become a perjury. That word has become loaded, and I don't want to give the impression that I'm looking down on organizations by calling them cults. The anthropological meaning of the term cult means a group that is led or founded and led by a charismatic leader. That's a cult in anthropological terms. And that certainly fitted all of our organizations at that time. When the founder dies or gives it to somebody else or whatever, then it becomes a sect. And a sect is the second generation, but the cult's the first generation when you have the charismatic leader. So when some of these some people, you know, use it as a derogatory term, and they call Mormonism a cult. No, Mormonism is absolutely not a cult. Couldn't possibly be, not unless Joseph Smith was still alive. And so that's a term. It means a small. It doesn't have to be small. It's a religious group or a spiritual group that is led by a charismatic leader. That's it. Now, so I use that term the way we define it in anthropology. Now, we started off and we covered the growth of the Western esoteric tradition all the way from Alexandria in the beginning all the way through to the Golden Dawn and the OTO and then on to their importation into this country. And this is the point that a lot of people that are witches and neo-pagans today don't understand. They don't understand how all this got started. And there are reasons for that, and the reasons why they don't understand it. One of the reasons is that cult, here I'm using that term again, cult leaders don't really want you sometimes, they don't really want you to know where they got what they what they're using. In fact, just recently, I ran across somebody who is in a version of a witchcraft order, and I'm not sure that this individual even knows who originally founded the tradition that this person happens to be a member of. They don't know. Because the head of the coven wouldn't tell them, and that quite often happens. Now, what happened was that over in England, you had Aleister Crowley with his, he took over the German Ordo Templi Orientis over there, and that was that. And then you had the various splinter groups breaking off from the Golden Dawn. Now, they came over to this country, both the Golden Dawn splinter groups and the OTO, and got over here in this country in the 1920s. And Paul Foster Case, you know, had a Golden Dawn charter, and then he modified it, of course, and took out the Enochian, and that became the BOTA and eventually became the Fraternity of Hidden Light. That all comes from that, from the Paul Case group. And Aleister Crowley, Wilford Smith, came had an OTO charter, and he started in the late 1920s. Here in Southern California, and that eventually went through Jack Parsons, and then went into a very interesting group, which we'll discuss tonight, which hardly anybody ever talks about anymore, and it's a fascinating and a terrifying story in many ways, and that is the Solar Lodge of the OTO that was led by Georgina and Richard Brayton over at USC, and they came to a very sad end. And we'll discuss that to some degree. But anyway, that's how the OTO and the Golden Dawn got over here. And then there were some Orthodox Golden Dawn groups too, because Bergardi belonged to one in New York. And then here's how the witchcraft groups got over here. Gerald Gardner started back, and Gerald Gardner, by the way, was really in tight with Aleister Crowley, and so there's a lot of Crowley influence in Gardnerianism, which they didn't want to admit for a long, long time. But Crowley helping Gardner, because Crowley's more literate than Gardner was, and they started right after the Witchcraft Act was finally dethroned or finally abrogated in England back in about 1948, they began to start this revival of, or they claimed it was a revival, of medieval witchcraft. And actually, whether it was medieval witchcraft or not, that's debatable, but it was certainly a pagan kind of a thing. And a little bit risque, and we won't go into too much of that. But anyway, they started that, and meanwhile, that was kind of very, very loosely based on Margaret Murray's material. But meanwhile, Robert Graves, the great English poet, and he had published this wonderful book, which we're going to devote a whole show to next week. It was a tremendous influence on the pagan movement and Farfaria and Order 1734 and all these various really, really serious pagan groups were tremendously influenced by Robert Graves' book, The White Goddess. And this was a marvelous piece of literature. And it's sort of the successor of Fraser's Golden Bough. It was a marvelous, marvelous thing, and it's difficult to understand. It's not an easy read, but it is just packed with esoteric lore and secrets and beautiful poetry and beautiful symbolism and whatever. This became the Bible of what you might call the intellectual end of witchcraft. And the proponent of white goddess magic, the first proponent, was Roy Bowers, Robert Cochrane, with his Order of 1734 over there in England. But over here in this country, it was Fred Adams with Farfaria. And Fred Adams, of course, had made the pilgrimage over to Majorca and had spent a weekend with Robert Graves. He had spent a lot of one over there. And Robert and the White Goddess was really a seminal influence on Farfaria. Farfaria, the Southern California neo-pagan nature cult, which I'm proud to be a member of and one of the old members of and still involved with it, And then, of course, 1734, meanwhile, Gardnerians came over through Ray Buckland. They were over here in the early 60s. We had a group that was remotely connected with 1734, but mostly kind of homegrown. By, as Bill and Helen Mose, I don't know, Jeff, whether you ever heard of the Moseyan tradition or what eventually became known as American Traditional, AmTrad. Did you ever hear of that one?
No, actually, I haven't heard of that one, but I certainly remember Fred Adams.
Oh, they, yeah, but no, yeah, but they, the Moses started off witchcraft here in the Los Angeles area, Southern California area. Bill and Helen Mose, and this is back in the very early 60s. And they, in fact, as a matter of fact, they initiated a lot of the witches that are getting to be our age, but they initiated, I think, Dave and Ann originally. They initiated some of the Gardnerian elders who were originally initiated by Bill and Helen. And Bill and Helen, they put their tradition together using a very eclectic mix. Ed Peach, you know, Ophiel, they used some of Ophiel's books, and they was kind of a mixture, like all witchcraft. It was a mixture of pagan elements and hermetic lore. And, you know, they tried to avoid direct Kabbalistic, they used Kabbalah, but it was always transliterated into some kind of pagan format. But, so that American traditional witchcraft was the first on this scene. And then, but meanwhile, of course, the OTO was going in its own little enclaves. And Rigardi was over in Studio City kind of licking his chops and getting ready for the psychedelic era at that time. He hadn't quite come back on the scene yet, but the Order of 1734, that came over with a Johnny Appleseed called Joe Wilson. Now, Jeff, you remember Joe Wilson?
Yes, I do remember him.
Oh yeah, crazy Joe. Joe was a wild man, but Joe was really a brilliant magician. I mean, he really was good. He started. He was kind of scattered all over the place, but he had Joe Wilson had corresponded with Roy Bowers, and Roy Bowers at 1734. It's very enigmatic, based on the White Goddess. Very enigmatic. Roy Bowers was very difficult to understand. He was very ambiguous, but he corresponded with Joe and gave Joe a great big stack of letters and gave Joe carte blanche to start the 1734 tradition in this country, which Joe did and initiated myself. And Jeanette, we both got initiated into 1734. So that was back in the in the early 70s. Let's see. And just got a note here, which I don't understand at all. Anyway. The 1734 got Wilson started that. Meanwhile, Ed Fitch, who is our good friend, and over in Texas now, Ed Fitch was initiated by Buckland. He got on the scene, and Gardnerian. He initiated several people into Gardnerianism, so the Gardnerians were on the scene. This is all back around 1970. This was all coming together in 1970. Feraferia had been going, and there was a group called Hesperides that Fred had started, and then that metamorphosized into Feraferia. Feraferia got started in 1968, and we came on the scene in 1969-70 with the OTA. And There was another group which figured rather prominently in all of this called the Church of the Eternal Source. And this was Egyptian. This was a reenactment of Egyptian tradition. You remember the Church of the Eternal Source, Jeff?
No, that I don't remember.
Well, they were Egyptian, and they did some really nice craftsmanship, and recreating Egyptian rituals and what have you. Let me point out some of the origins of what was underlying the creation of paganism and the platform from which it arose here in Southern California. There had been, arising from, in the 1950s, arising out of the science fiction community, and you know, Lospis is the oldest science fiction fan club, I think, in the whole country, and it was here in Los Angeles, and Jack Parsons and Jack Williams and all those guys, they were all either members or hung around Lospis. And Lospis gave birth to and this is one that hardly anybody remembers anymore, they gave birth to a strange group called the Chesley Donovan Society. Now, the Chesley Donovan Society was entirely, they created their own mythology, they had their own Grand Duchess, they had their own language. They even created a language called Donovanian, and they created a fictitious kind of a Balkan country in Europe that they're all supposed to have come down from, and this was a complete it was like a role playing game, and this was all in the late 1950s that they did this, and like I said, they had their own language and their own ceremonies and everything, and then they even created a perihelion ceremony, and these guys were all science fiction fans, and they claimed to be agnostics. They didn't want to worship anything, but yet what they were really doing, though, and they were, of course, romantic, obviously, but they were doing was they were creating what the prototype of a neo-pagan cult. And you can see, you can see this desire to create this thing, to create their own fantasy and live in it. And this was the Chesley Donovan Society, and so when all the factors came together, when the psychedelic era hit, and people were suddenly taking doses of spirituality, and college kids were turning on and all of that, that's when people who had been yearning for this romantic expression. That's when the witchcraft and magic and all really took off. Now, Jeff, you probably didn't hear too much about the Silver Lodge, but maybe I can remind you of it when I say that was the group that were stigmatized by the Boy in the Box scandal. Do you recall that one?
No, I think that might have been before my time.
No, I don't. I'm not so sure. It was around 1969,
I was only 15 then, so.
Well, you were too young. You were a little too young for Georgina Brayton to get her hooks into you, but here's how that went down, and that's a story that's good for a whole book in itself. Georgina Brayton was the wife of Professor Richard Brayton, who taught at USC. And they were well off, and they owned three great big old houses, big old brownstones down around USC, that they rented out these three story houses. They rented them out to college students at USC, and Georgina Brayton had studied with one of the OTO ladies left over from Agape Lodge, Mimi Burlingame, and she was an ardent Thelemite. And she imagined in her own mind that she was the, I guess, you know, she was the incarnation of Babylon. I know. I don't know whether she knew Cameron or not, but I mean, Georgina imagined, after studying with Mimi for a while, she imagined that she was the Avatrix of the new eon, and so and Richard Brayton, her husband, and he was a little more pragmatic, but he enjoyed it, and so they started this what they called the Solar Lodge at the OTO. Now, they got a little bookstore. They bought a little bookstore, and they called it the Eye of Horus. And they started this recruiting among college students that they were, you know, at USC. They got about 50 active members, and this was a very, very, very tight-knit, very tightly controlled. These kids were really true believers. I mean, this was a very, very, very potent and very powerful, for its size, organization. And Georgina was, she was a bit, obsessed. And, you know, what they ended up having a commune out in the desert. They bought themselves some land out around Needles out in the desert. And then they had the kids going out there and building a whole communal setup out there. They put up a big Quonset hut. They put up, and they drilled a well, and they really got, got themselves a little community out there. And they were into this apocalypse, this doomsday thing. It's going to be us against them, you know, whatever. And what happened was is that they ended up making a mistake of taking the child of one of the members, a 9-year-old boy who was hyperactive and emotionally disturbed, and they sent him out there to that commune out in the desert. And the kid burned down the whole complex, and they ended up putting the kid, restraining him, because he was running around like a wild animal and hurting himself and everything else. So they, for one night, they shut him up in a packing crate. They were all sleeping in packing crates out there. And the sheriff swooped down on them, and the story ended up that they had this kid chained in this box for 56 days. And this was a nationwide scandal. I mean, the whole thing just blew up. It was all horrendous child abuse. And they got these poor teenage college students, or, you know, in their 19 and 20, and they got about 9 of these kids, and they put them in jail, and they just ruined their whole lives. And the kids hadn't done anything wrong, really. And they got this, they got the kid, they suborned perjury with one of the guys to agree that the kid had been chained in the box for 56 days and all this. And this was a horrendous scandal. Meanwhile, the Braytons took off. They wouldn't stand up for them. They took off for Mexico, and this whole thing just was awful. And the Riverside Sheriff's Department and the newspaper out there, and the prosecutor, the district attorney, and all of them, they went on a witch hunt. It was terrible.
Literally.
One of my grad student friends, who was in the same grad student class that I was, he had been a member of that thing, and he was lucky, he himself was lucky, that he wasn't able to be out there at the time it happened, but his girlfriend was, his fiancée, and she committed suicide as a result of this. They put these kids in jail, and they wouldn't turn them loose, and they charged them with misdemeanors, but then they just kept them in prison indefinitely, and the poor girl committed suicide. It was terrible. So anyway, the story of the Solar Lodge is one that I researched and had, you know, personal informants and all of that on those. So that's a story that has not been told. And it should be. Georgina's passed on now, and she's, that's the end of that. But we went on, you know, on to cover, and I mentioned it the other night, when we did the show on politics, magical politics, I mentioned the Themis War, when Fred Adams started the Ecumenical Council of Pagan Groups, and how that fell apart. And I'm not going to, I've covered that in detail in the thesis here, and I don't pull any punches on that one. Except that, I will say this before anybody gets out there listening, gets too worried. The one individual that really, really was responsible for all the mess in the Themis War, and it wasn't Tim Zell, by the way, the one individual that was really, really responsible for the mess, aside from Jefferson Poland, I've used a pseudonym, and even in my thesis, I used a pseudonym for him, because not that he deserves it, but I use a pseudonym for him. Other than that, we pretty much told the story. And the Themis War was very sad, but it sort of set the stage for the eventual politicizing of the neo-pagan movement, which I have covered to some degree. You're familiar, Jeff. You remember when the feminists rolled in and took over the neo-pagan movement, don't you?
Oh, that was really something. It was actually, we were at a meeting at an apartment somewhere in I can't remember, West LA or something like that. And your wife happened to suggest that it might be wise for neo-pagans to reproduce, have children. That might be a good idea. Otherwise, we're not going to grow on. And there were a bunch of about five or six really hardcore feminist neo-pagans who just jumped all over her and were just so into it, you know. Oh, you're not going to tell me what to do with my body, you know, like she made some incredible, horrible, you know, patriarchal statement or something. It was really ridiculous. And my understanding is that they kept on reviling her for weeks afterwards, if I recall.
Yeah. By the way, Ann Finnan, Ann, go ahead, give us a call. I think we can talk about this now, because the feminist movement is still very, very powerful in paganism, especially up in the San Francisco area. And they're still very powerful, and they still have a lot of influence, but at least the pagan movement has normalized to the extent that we don't have, that I didn't notice, at least the Pantheon last time, I didn't notice this hands-off women's religion stuff. You know, the
I honestly don't think that feminism as it exists today is beating the same drums that they were beating, 25 years ago.
Oh, no.
It's completely changed. It's completely changed. But back then, it was pretty raw. It had sort of a raw philosophy. I believe that was right around the time that, Catherine MacKinnon became popular and some of the more radical, you know, just kind of anti-male, anti-sex, hard feminism. I think it's pretty much lost that, except in some academic circles. I don't think you see it anymore in neo-pagan.
Yeah, you're right. Now, just speak along that line. Ann, are you on?
Yeah,
are you there?
I'm right here, Polk. Uh-huh.
Okay. You remember Jeff, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward to his book.
Yeah.
Hi, Ann.
Well.
Hey, Jeff.
Yeah, anyway, Ann, you want to add to, I remember when this, when they, after Themis, when they, I started a couple of councils after that, and those of us who really didn't want to get into this hands off women's religion thing, naturally they didn't want us to either. We had some interesting confrontations with them, especially up there in the Bay Area. I remember you and Dave went up to some of those meetings. Do you want to talk about that, or are you still a little sensitive about it?
Oh, no. It gets better. It really does. Talking about whether it's gone away or not, it hasn't. Just as an aside to run you up to last PantheaCon, You guys all remember Z Budapest, right?
Oh yeah.
Well, she caused a kerfuffle up in at Pantheon because she wanted to do a women's only ritual, and a whole bunch of transgendered fellas wanted to join the ritual, and she wouldn't let them, and they staged a sit-in protest out in front of her her ritual room, and there was a big kerfuffle about the fact that she only wanted physical women that transgendered or transvestite fellas need not apply. And there was a whole kerfuffle about it being discriminatory and how she was such a bigot and all this other stuff. It was really quite fun.
You know, really, she is, I got to, you know, even though she caused, I think, far more problems than anybody else. But she really did some amusing things. I remember she gave a lecture to a group of anthropology faculty and graduate students one time. And in the course of the lecture, when she's talking about the history of the Western tradition, she said, "Well, you all know that Alexander the Pig burned the library at Alexandria."
Alexander the Pig?
Alexander the Pig burned the library at Alexandria. Well, of course, immediately, everybody, male and female, in the audience just, you know, and that was the end of her. But, now, I don't think, and I've met Z and I've talked with her and all that, I don't think Z Budapest was really, when she said that, I don't think she's really that dumb, and I don't think she's really that uneducated. I think that represented an attack on the entire intellectual aspect of the neo-pagan movement. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, and she's still doing it. You know, it's sort of one of these things that for some people it will always be 1968, and she's one of them. You know, it's her only claim to fame.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, let's don't beat her. I'm not going to say she's the dead horse yet, but we've got to get away from that because we don't want to spend too much time ragging her.
But it's the attitude. It's the attitude.
And of course, the problem here is that there's a lot of things, and I'm going to have to be honest about this. There's a lot of things about the feminist movement that were justified and were, you know, and they were certainly true and all of that. But it went too far. Anyway, I think we finally got to the point where we can look back on this and say, well, at least some of them still do, and yet paganism. The pagan movement, I think, is we're back to where we are no longer terrified of these people, and we're no longer, you know, trying to hide from them. The thing I'd like to ask my viewer on here is the 1734 transmission, and you want to talk a little bit about how you went back to England and got the real stuff and came back and everything and developed the robot?
Well, the fun part about the whole 1734 thing is that it was a cult within a cult. It was one of these things where you had to really be in the know and you had to know people who knew people in order to get a copy of the Cochrane material, because it wasn't published anywhere. It wasn't even available to anybody who you didn't, you know, who wasn't vouched for. And it was the super secret stuff. And it consisted of some letters that Joe Wilson had received from Robert Cochrane in 1966. And it was, they were something that was very different from the Gardnerian Eye of Newton, Toe of Frog brand of witchcraft at the time. It was very philosophical. It was very mystical. and it was based on a lot of on Robert Graves' White Goddess that you spoke about earlier, and it was devotional rather than ceremonial, and there were bits and pieces of traditional lore that was involved in there, but for the most part, it was philosophy rather than rituals.
Yeah.
And this was something that was totally and completely different from anything anybody had ever seen. So
yeah, I read across that glossy. By the way, I've got that glossy of the men here of the in France.
That big.
I know you got it too. That glossy of that men here. And I still can't figure that thing out. I think I'm not even sure Bowers could figure it out, or if he could. Yeah, I don't know. We all love a mystery, and nobody loved a mystery more than Bowers.
This was his stock and trade, and Joe Wilson was a very effective audience for a lot of this that he was writing. To the very end of his life, he committed suicide in 1966. We found out later that his wife had left him and taken their young son, and in despair, he had taken an overdose of belladonna and librium and lingered for several days and finally died in hospital. And it was very tragic, and everybody was very, very stunned by it, and things kind of shut down on that score for many, many years. Nobody would talk about him. Nobody would admit that they knew him. And there's still a controversy floating around about whether
Roy,
or not
this is Roy he was, Bowers we're talking. Let's get
yeah,
that,
this is
let's
Roy
get,
Bowers.
Let's clarify that. Roy Bowers we're talking about.
Yeah,
right.
And he wrote under the name of Robert Cochran. He wrote several articles for a pamphlet called Pentagram back in the day. So this stuff was a corpus of material that only Joe Wilson or somebody who was connected with Joe Wilson had. And one of the interesting things that you mentioned earlier about Bill and Helen Mose is they had a copy of this stuff because they had worked with Joe Wilson back in the Midwest somewhere, Kansas, I believe. And they had this material, which they incorporated into their Book of Shadows. So you can open their Book of Shadows, and you can find, if you know what you're looking for, you can find the Cochrane quotes and lore and bits.
Now, that I did not know. This is the first time I knew that. I knew they had some influence, but
No,
they
had the whole
material.
They do.
Oh, boy.
Probably not as complete, but they certainly had the letters. Because they were Joe received them in 1966, so anybody who worked with Joe after that had access to this stuff. And of course, nobody, Joe Wilson being Joe Wilson, would never tell anybody where he got the stuff from. And so you had the bits and pieces of Roy's letters floating around all over the place that nobody knew where it came from. Because
to get down to the nitty-gritty on this thing, though, is you and Dave went over to England and actually talked to some of the members of Roy's original coven.
And interestingly enough, the contact was Bill Gray, who apparently had worked with Roy and knew him rather well and had a series of correspondence from him over the years and apparently worked in his group for year or two before he died.
Yeah,
so
Jeff,
are you
still there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, good. You remember Bill Gray, and we used to correspond with him rather regularly. You know, he was one of the British witches, and became then he slipped into ceremonial magic, I guess, after Roy died, and Bill Gray wrote a terrific. A wonderful book called Magical Ritual Methods.
I remember that one. I still have that in my library.
Yeah, well, that's got one of the best visualization methods. We used that to improve Barden a little bit because, Barden tells you what to do, but he doesn't tell you how to do it. Anyway, let me talking about this thesis here that we got. Let me go over a few things here. That I got a chapter in here, chapter 7, called Three Neo-Pagan Cults in Southern California, and I did Farfaria, and I did the OTA, and let's see, what else did I do? I did the OTA, and I did the church. Well, the Church of the Eternal Source. I called it something else. So, and what I wanted to do here is explain that to get to the thesis part of this. In other words, the anthropology part. We've been talking about how things were and where things got started and all that kind of business, but we have to look at this. I had to look at this from an anthropological point of view. Otherwise, I couldn't have, they wouldn't have given me an MA and patted me on the back and whatever. And so what I had to do is find a model. And the model for this, I used Anthony Wallace's revitalization, his revitalization cult idea. And so what I did is I said, okay, this is a resurgence of the Romantic movement, and we're using a spiritual base for it. And so Anthony Wallace had come up with, he's an anthropologist, he came up with this idea of revitalization cults. And what he termed a revitalization cult was when a cultural group, an ethnic group or something, feels like they're disempowered, and they feel a sense of enemy, and they feel like they've been kind of forgotten and their religion no longer, or the religion that they are using no longer does it for them. They go back to what they, either a reconstruction of their roots or the actual roots, they recover something and they come up with it and they say, this is who we are. And they go on a kind of, it's kind of a revival. It's almost like, the perfect example of this, the perfect example which Wallace uses is the Plains Indians ghost dance movement. The ghost dancers, I know we've all heard about that. That was after the Indian Wars and after we had whipped the hell out of them and put them all on reservations and made them miserable and killed all the buffalo and given them smallpox and made them feel like third-class citizens and everything else, then they had the ghost dance. And this was their revitalization. And they actually, the ghost dance was really kind of half Christian, because the Indian shaman who developed it, he'd already kind of halfway converted to Christianity. So it was sort of a combination of the Book of Revelations and the Indian legends. But it still was Indian. In other words, it was American Indian. And it was a, and of course, it scared the hell out of the government, the army, and everything. But this is a revitalization movement. It's a culture, a depressed culture that wants its roots back. Well, now, so Christianity no longer did it for young people in that era, the Vietnam War and the psychedelic era and all that. The young people, Christianity, that was old hat. They wasn't doing anything for them. So they wanted an expression. They felt disempowered. They felt frustrated. And paganism and magic, too, which is kind of, it's paganism underlied. Even if you're Rosicrucian, there's strong pagan elements in it. And so this was a revitalization movement. I said, and I called it a resurgence of the Romantic movement. And so this was what I, Jeff, you want to comment on that?
Actually, Polk, I wanted to ask you a question about this. And it had to do with do you think that over the years, the barrier between neo-paganism and kind of high magic has become more permeable or less permeable? Do you think there's more movement back and forth between the two or less? because I feel like you've got such a long perspective on it that you'd be able to see the trends probably better than just about anybody else.
Well, I to answer that, there may be this may you may be asking me to agree with what I want to agree with, and so you have to take that into consideration. I want to say you're right, because that's what the OTA was from the beginning. It was a synthesis of the pagan and the traditional, and traditional magic, and we had problems with this, because the pagan, the out and out pagans, they thought we were hermetic and biblical. And then the biblical, you know, the people that were into Rosicrucians, they thought we were pagan, and nobody. So we would have people, you know, now finally after all this time, we're really people are beginning to accept this, the connection between the Kabbalah and hermetic. The Hermetic tradition and paganism, and we've used, you know, when I started all this off and wrote the seasonal ceremonies and everything else, that was before I became a Mason, actually. But then once I became a Mason, I realized, hey, Hiram of Tyre and Hiram of Biff and even Solomon were all pagans, and the Kabbalah is pagan, and so what, you know, why? Why can't people realize this? And Masons, you know, we got the three Grand Masters of Masonry, and all three of them are pagan. And so, you know, what's the problem here? So yes, I think people are finally beginning to realize this, that there is a synthesis, and of course the fundamental Christians and Orthodox Jews have always believed that any kind of occultist is a pagan, as far as they're concerned. You know what I mean? Yes, I think we're finally bridging the gap. I think we're finally doing this, and obviously, you know, our recent growth and all of that's bearing us out. Now, but that's what I want to think. Now, what do you think about that? Anne, what do you think?
I think that it depends on the group, but From down here on the ground in the deep in the Wicca weeds here, there's absolutely a not just a synthesis but a merging. Gardnerian witchcraft is basically pagan ceremonial magic. I mean, if you go back to Gardner's original work, sure, and some of the original rituals, which we have just recently been introduced to again. Particularly Alexandrian Wicca or witchcraft, yeah, is ceremonial magic only pagan. They worship the goddess and the old gods and all of this, but you have the Kabbalah, you have ceremonial magic, you have in some cases archangels at the quarters, you have the Golden Dawn quarter system. You have all of the aethers, and you have all of the elemental kings, and you have all of that stuff in a pagan format. And Wicca, 30, 40 years down the line here, particularly in this country, have no clue where any of that comes from. It was in Ray Buckland's Big Blue Book, and therefore it's Wicca, and we don't question it. It's what we do, and we wave our athames in an invoking pentagram gesture at the quarters, and call upon Oriel and Michael and what have you, and the watchtowers of the east and the watchtowers of the west, and invoke the goddess and the god, and join hands and dance on the maple.
I have kind of an interesting historical point from the other end of it, which is the point that Polk said, that much of the Kabbalah actually comes from pagan sources. It turns out that we have a tendency to look at history, particularly history of biblical times, through the lens
of the Old Testament as it was collected together in about the first or second century. And when they actually look at artifacts from the period before, before the Christian era, you find out that that far from being like the Judaism that we came to know in medieval times, or that mostly that we see Judaism is, that actually it had a lot of an enormous amount of pagan influence and Greek influence, and their religious objects had it was far more syncretic than you would lead you to believe when you look at it from the view of the Old Testament, and that particular view of Judaism was reinforced actually when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they found the original early manuscripts of the Book of Enoch, which is very much angels and demons and spirits very much a magical handbook, and was at that time a big part of Jewish thought that was later on expunged. So Pope makes an absolutely valid point, which is that the Kabbalah's original source is covalent with the source of Greek magic and Roman magic
To go along with what you're saying here, I think you probably read Kieran Berry's Greek Kabbalah, and in this, and since it's a scholarly work, it's very well done. He points out that the Kabbalah, as we have it, was originally Greek. Because the Greeks were equating, they were regularly equating their alphabet with the numerical equivalents before the Hebrews started doing it. Even though the Hebrews may have had something along that line, but the key to this is that the Septuagint has the numbers in the Bible. We're all in Greek letters, to indicate the numbers. And frankly, we published in the latest Seventh Ray, and this is a plug for those of you who haven't gotten it, at the Green Ray, we published the extrapolation of Marcus's second century Summa Sophia system. And Marcus, the Valentinian magician, who was a Gnostic Christian, more or less, he really had a lot to do with what eventually became the Hebrew Kabbalah.
There's also another connection, Polk, another kind of interesting connection, too. If you trace back the history of magical sigils, the signatures that are made up of either laying patterns over magic squares or combinations of the letters into where they take the letters and kind of cram them together, you find a separate line coming down through the medieval manuscripts like the Key of Solomon, and then another line coming through Greek manuscripts that's actually quite different. And it shows that method shows up, and you can kind of trace it back to the roots. It's likely that all that stuff came out about the same time. That maybe certainly you can trace it back to like the 11th or 12th century, and then probably earlier. But the fact that there's multiple trees of that way of thinking shows that if you trace it back, it probably comes back to some original source sometime in the early centuries of the Christian era.
Oh, yeah. And what we have, if you want to put the Kabbalah together, the structure of it, as far as the Tree of Life is concerned, is obviously Mesopotamian. And probably if the Hebrews had that much to do with it, it was during the captivity, that they got it from, and along with the planetary attributes. And one thing that some Orthodox Kabbalists will try to tell you is that the Kabbalah really doesn't have that much to do with planetary attributes. That is horsepucky, because anybody who has a full set of the Zohar knows that that's not true. The astrology and planetary characteristics are very, very heavy in the Kabbalah. I mean,
There's a tendency, there's a tendency in, particularly in academic circles, to want to strip off the synchronicism and the connections between things like that. You see it in Taoism, for example, is that when people talk about Taoism, they always talk about it in its highest philosophical form and don't really address the fact that it's actually a set of magical practices, and people practice magic under Taoism, and there's a lot of spirits and things like that connected with it. I think the same thing happens with the Kabbalah. The people look at it, that people who study it in like as part of their Jewish education or part of an academic background want to raise it to its highest philosophical level, which is very abstract and very disconnected with its real roots, when in fact it was a form of practical magic originally and was in that form when it originally became part of the Hebrew culture.
This is one of the reasons why magic is universal. At least it's universal to what we call the West. Now, what we call the West is really not that much the West, because we're going all the way from Mesopotamia all the way to even from India, even Persia and India, and all of this is. So I don't know whether what we call the Western tradition might better be called the Mideast and Western tradition, maybe, because we're getting the only thing we didn't tap into too much was the Chinese. They developed their own thing, pretty much isolated from us. Interestingly enough, they came up with some systems that were similar, but obviously derived from, the I Ching and geomancy. Now, geomancy is kind of Western, and the I Ching is obviously Chinese. But they're both these binary systems. They're both, and I think in a way they may have developed independently, because like the Abel, the spear thrower. They were the Abos in Australia developed the spear thrower, and the American Indians way over developed the spear thrower, and there probably wasn't any connection between the two. So. But I would draw the line. I really would. I'd draw the line. But then here's another fascinating thing, and I dealt with this in the thesis, in my thesis here. And recently, there was a book that we mentioned a little while back, A Spear Waiting to Pierce You. And in this book, I'm trying to remember the guy's name, but. Wrote it anyway. Peter Kingsley, in A Spear Waiting to Pierce You. He's talking about the and I don't know whether you're familiar with this, Jeff, but that supposedly, according to several anthropologists way back from the 1930s on, that they theorized that the inspiration for Greek mystical philosophy, for the Pythagorean, for the Orphic. And the whole Greek shamanic philosophy that became Greek mysticism and gave rise to philosophy originally came from the Altai Mountains of Mongolia, and that these were the Hyperboreans that brought this down, and Apollo and the Orphic philosophy, and by the way, that Orphic philosophy figures very heavily in 1734. Anne, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here. And in fact, I might add that one of the tales about Pythagoras was that he was supposed to have spent many years studying with the Druids, and that there's an awful lot of Druidic pure magic and that kind of thing in case and Pythagorean philosophy, and that the Druids were, of course, mystics as well, and did shamanic journeying and things like that, and it found its way into Pythagorean philosophy. So
Dobbs, and then later Kingsley, they're saying that the inspiration comes down from the Altai, and somebody. And then some other people are suggesting, Kingsley doesn't, and Dobbs doesn't, but other people are suggesting that, well, they came down from the Altai with a leather sack full of dried Amanita, and that's what started this whole thing off. Yeah, well, maybe so. I don't know, but let's put it this way. The Scythians were probably the ones who were up in the Altai, the shamans. In other words, the idea is a Siberian Altai Central Asian shamanism is supposed to have had an influence on our highest philosophy. You guys heard about that?
I've heard of the Scythians being, I've also heard of the Scythians being refugees from Atlantis as well. So it depends on how far back you go. But the Scythians were horsemen. They had a horse cult very similar to the Celts in terms of the horse being a sacred animal and one of their goddesses having the form of a horse.
Yeah,
and
well,
so there's a lot of
yeah.
dovetailing culturally as well.
Now, Scott Littleton over at Occidental College started off this idea that the Sarmatians were the original bearers of the Holy Grail and they were the original King Arthur and all that. Somebody even made a movie about this called
yeah.
Arthur,
yeah.
King Arthur. And it may be true. I mean, it could be. But that was a Scythian culture. I don't know how much Roy Bowers knew about this, but there's a horse symbolism, of course, in 1734.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. And the reason for that was one of the things that, getting back to your comment about the Orphic Mysteries, that was very much a part of that. It was a bardic cult. Bowers made a big thing about riddles and poetry being something that would convey information and knowledge rather than lecturing and you know, prose. That is very much not just Greek Orphic tradition, but it's the Celtic Bardic tradition as well, Welsh, where you've got...
I want you to call in next week. We're going to do the White Goddess, which means I'm going to have to get back in and review the White Goddess, so I got a lot of reading to do. We'll have fun with the White Goddess next week. And you know, though, we need to do that because there are so many people in this new generation here who just don't know about the White Goddess. They don't realize that this is, you know, this is one of the Bibles that you have to read. I mean, and so we'll have fun with that next week.
We use it as an initiation test. If you can get through the White Goddess and answer a few fundamental questions about it, then you've passed the initiation test.
Boy, yeah. Well, the White Goddess, as we said, is not an easy read, but it is. I can't emphasize too much how important it is. And, of course, we use it in our pathworking, you know, we use White Goddess the tree alphabet in our pathworking system. Fred Adams, and that, I covered that here in the thesis, Fred Adams used the White Goddess extensively in creation of Feraferia. And the tree alphabet in the White Goddess is vitally important. You might also, you might say that's a sort of a druidic Kabbalah.
It is, very much.
Very definitely. And yet, at the same time, I want to mention that Robert Graves, and this is something that we should be aware of, that Robert Graves is reconstructing something. He's reconstructing something based not entirely on research, but also on intuition. And he's not trying to fool. He's not like some of these people today who write these things, write these books on the bloodlines of this, that, and the other thing and all that kind of business. He's not trying to say all this is fact and this is exactly the way it was. He's not trying to say that. And we should understand that what he's doing is he's doing an intuitive reconstruction of the ancient European initiatic code. And as such, it's a masterpiece. But it is not it's not history. I mean, it is in one way, but it's history seen through his intuition, and he had a wonderful intuition. You'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Oh yeah, yeah. In fact, he says that right up front. Not only in the foreword to The White Goddess, but in some of his other essays about the difference between Orphic and Dionysian and Apollonian thought processes, that one being linear and rational and didactic, and then the other being more intuitive and emotional and gestalt, and that academia, particularly in the last 300 or 400 years, has been so obsessed with things being factual that when something comes along that is, some of the books in the Bible and some of the books in Celtic myth, where is it history or is it myth? Well, it's both. Well, how can it be both? Well, did these things really happen, or are they just stories? Well, yes. You know, so you have this, what is history? It's a tale told by the victor. You know, so that's what he's trying to do, is to say not everything is in history and in culture is physical. That some things are metaphorical, some things are psychic. Astral, if you will.
I want to read you something here that I wrote regarding what you're saying, and let's see, these writers, and I'm talking about Graves and the rest of them, are reasserting the primary importance of cosmic and natural phenomena beyond certain significant myth themes. For example, Samson, Hercules, and Gilgamesh, as cited by Nisaba and von Deccan, and the Sumerian myth of Enlil, cited by Ackerman. The implication is that pre-scientific intellect was as sophisticated in its own magical poetic context as any present epistemology. Although they would probably concede this, Levi-Strauss and his fellow structuralists are often prone to ignore it, treating ancient and primitive myths as if they were the results of TAT tests given to children. Using an historico-evolutionary model, I might suggest that the land of Descartes, producing a prodigal son, Prince Claude, the Strauss of Levy, who, like many heroes of Raglan's model, is utterly ignorant of his patrimony. Now, that's my William Buckley-ish answer to some of those critics. These reductions, these people actually are anti-cultural. They're anti-cultural. It doesn't matter whose culture it is, they're against it. And culture is for them the enemy. And yet, at the same time, some of them are cultural anthropologists. And it really is, you know, when you don't appreciate what it is that you're supposed to be a specialist in, I find it rather disturbing, this attitude. And yet that is the attitude of a large segment of the intelligentsia.
You find that in psychology, too. You find that they are so determined to be unbiased that they don't realize that they are biased, and it's an unconscious bias rather than a natural conscious bias. So they don't know they're being biased, and they will deny that they're being biased, but their cultural assumptions are that everybody's an idiot but them, you know, and that's the cultural assumption. Everybody's culture is stupid except theirs. And they can put themselves in their little ivory tower and think that they are being objective about other people's cultures when, of course, they are not. And that's why it's so frustrating, is that you can see the bias.
Oh, yeah.
You can, here it is 40-50 years later, and you can see the bias. It's like reading Gombada, you know, and you can see the feminist bias in every word she writes.
Oh yeah,
it's very obvious.
The thing about anti-culturalism is political, and it is ferociously political, because the reason is that culture has power. Mores and folkways are a cultural phenomenon, and they have power. And you don't go against the mores and the folkways of people. But in order to politically manipulate people, these mores and folkways have to be broken down. And so this becomes it becomes kind of a political thing. And so the preservation of culture, now granted, culture is also, you know, in many ways, culture is the enemy. It's against progress. It's against, you know, it frustrates people, and it holds them back, and it can be abused, and it can become corrupt, and all of that. So culture has to be modified. Culture has to be. But culture is really what defines humanity. And so I can't agree with the anti-cultural point of view. I think culture should be constantly transformed, constantly evolved. But I'm very much pro-pagan and very much pro-romantic and all of that. So I suppose that, how do you feel about that?
What, that you're pro-pagan and pro-romantic? I think it's fine.
I know. You're pro-pagan and pro-romantic, too. But you know...
But at least you admit it. You know, at least you know and are willing to acknowledge that that's the bias you're coming from. It's more honest than somebody who's coming along and saying, insisting that they are unbiased and unaffected by their own prejudices and their own preferences, saying otherwise. And
well,
so your evaluation of things would be a lot more honest than someone who is coming along and insisting that they are above all of that.
But I do want to point this out, though, before we have to end up. One of the things that I did deal with in this thesis, and I dealt with it the other night when we talked about politics, is that because of Ariosophy in Europe which gave the Nazis a mythos to use for propaganda purposes and all of this, because of the rise of Nordic paganism, or if you want to call it that, in Europe before World War II, now after World War II and in that era, anything that smacked of a pagan revival was immediately thought of by this particular intellectual set as being, here we go, here are the Nazis, here come the Nazis again. And the American pagan movement, even with the feminists and all the rest of this, there's nothing Nazi about it. Oh, sure, there's a few Nordic groups, that little oddball Nordic groups that we never did accept them too much into the pagan movement. That, you know, some of them wanted shock value, they'd wave a swastika around. But that's not where the pagan movement has ever been at. And yet we got tarred with this. And in fact, the Romanticism in general got tarred with this. And it's a darn shame, because modern American neo-paganism and magic and all that have nothing to do with that stuff. And that brings up the point that we don't believe, but nobody in these days believes in secret chiefs or, you know, I mean, the cult leader does not tell you, I'm in touch with the secret chiefs, and the secret chiefs have told us that we all have to go out and buy lots and lots of new broccoli. We have to go out and eat broccoli. We all have to do that because the secret chiefs tell us to. Now, I think you'd be laughed out of a coven or a lodge these days if anybody tried to come up with that. Would you agree with that?
To a certain extent. I have heard of covens where probably not that outrageous, but I have heard of covens who are convinced that their high priestess is a mouthpiece of a particular goddess and she who must be obeyed and all of that. Now, having said
they should take a lesson from what happened to Georgina Brayton. Georgina Brayton thought that she was the Avatrix of the Aeon, and look what happened to them.
they meet much the same fate, particularly if half of their group leave and the other half become so obsessive about it that they end up moving in and taking over, which is also one of the things that happens in groups like this, is that they foster the minion mentality, and the minions decide that they're going to move in and mooch. That's happened more than once.
Well, this is the whole community. This is something I did. By the way, this is something else I dealt with. We don't. Most of us in the pagan movement are not into this commune thing. Most of us are not. And the whole commune thing doesn't work out very well in the United States. I don't know. It might work out. It didn't work out very well for the Tibetans either. But I mean, this whole idea of starting these communes is just not something that the modern pagan movement's really gotten into, fortunately. Anyway, we got to go. And next week, however, call in again next week, because we're going to do the White Goddess next week. We're really going to get into it. And all of the influences and whatever, and read some Gravesian poetry and have a grand time. So we'll see you next week, and we'll unveil the greatest secrets that the Master Graves has bequeathed to us. Meanwhile, have a good one and good magic.